Welcome back, Ruby Tuesday. As always, I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and today on the podcast, we're going to talk about the NBA playoffs, only from a slightly different perspective, because joining me is Edon Ravine. Now, if you're a basketball junkie, you may know Edon as the guy behind the guys, personal basketball trainer to players like LeBron James, Kevin Durant, Chris Paul, Carmelo Anthony, and honestly, too many others to list here. He's somebody who helps good players become great, and great players become even better. In fact, he's been labeled the Hoops Whisperer. And not coincidentally, that's also the title of his new book, plug, 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 The Hoops Whisperer, on the court and inside the heads of basketball's best players. So we're going to get on the court and in those heads right now. Edon, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, buddy.
Oh, this is great. And by the way, I'm in D.C., and you're actually somewhat local, right? You split your time between D.C. and New York now?
Yeah, I grew up in Potomac, in Maryland.
Terrific. This is a great, for those of you out there that don't realize that or don't know, D.C. is a great basketball area, long tradition, so it makes a little bit of sense here. I want to start with another D.C. connection, something that happened earlier this week. Kevin Durant, who's originally from this area, he won the MVP award. Now, obviously, he had a phenomenal season. He's obviously been a phenomenal player for years, and he's someone who clearly is devoted to his craft and wants to get better. But still, you write something very interesting in the book. This struck me right away. You say, when you're working with top athletes, top players, guys that are at the pinnacle of their career, that the more they accomplish, sometimes that can actually make it harder for them to improve. Because trying new things and risking failure becomes much more difficult. How do you see that working with these guys? And how do you help push them really accomplish comfortable people out of those comfort zones?
I mean, I want you to think about it, right? The better you get, sort of the higher you operate in the clouds, which means that there's a lot farther to fall. So when you're a great, great player, think about the distance from the top to the ground. It's pretty hard, right? So sometimes in that space, people are reluctant because they're afraid of the consequence. So what you do is you try to create an environment that's free from that, right? That they're not thinking about the fall, they're just thinking about what they can gain from it. So you create an environment that's transparent, that's comfortable, that's like a sanctuary, that the only laughter comes from having fun, not from ridicule or criticism. And that way you encourage them to fall a lot, but not think about it as a hard fall, but more just kind of as progress.
So how does that work when you're actually training with a guy like KD, you're training with LeBron? You know, what kind of environment do you look for? How many people are there? What are we talking about? You know, take me into the gym. What am I gonna see? What am I gonna feel?
Like, I don't like having anyone in the gym. It's not necessary. I mean, it's, you know, sometimes in sports you have this people like observing. And I always thought, you know what? If I was an accountant, would you be watching me do my debits and credits and all that stuff? No. And so I never understand that purpose. I like to have it when there's absolutely no one in the gym. It doesn't have to be a sexy gym. It could be something. It's just barren, if anything. You know, I don't need to have Gatorade bottles and a lot of equipment, but it's just a place where they feel at home, where there's no cell phone cameras or YouTube or someone documenting their mistakes, where they can be completely transparent, where they can curse and yell and scream and laugh and do all those things that they would do, you know, in their own home. So I just try to make it just comfortable for them.
I'm talking about sort of making things comfortable, but the same, like you said, pushing out of those comfort zones, getting through to guys. I mean, when these guys are at the best at what they do, is it ever difficult to get through to them? Okay, but here's the ways that you could get a lot better. Here's the things you're not so much the best at. Do you find that, you know, are they generally pretty open to that, or do you have to sort of get them to a point where they're open to that?
I mean, these guys are incredibly smart. I think there's this idea that just because you play basketball at the highest level, that's all you can do. These guys live the American dream. These guys have pursued this since they were young kids, and they make a king's ransom doing what they would otherwise do for free. So they're very, very, very smart, and they can smell magic beans in about 3 seconds. So when you walk into a gym, you better know what you're talking about, and then you better believe your own gospel, because if you don't, they're going to walk out in a few seconds. And when I come in there, I don't tell them what to do. I don't order them around. I don't yell at them. It's a collaborative. You know, I give them some suggestions. They think about it. We walk it through. We do a drill. They get it. They understand why it's challenging. It humbles them because it's something they're not necessarily used to doing. And that's how the progress starts. I mean, this is not the Marine Corps. I don't walk in there, curse 5,000 times, tell them what to do. It's not that at all. It's a very, like, calm place. And I push them into a place of discomfort, but in a gentle way. I'm challenging them. I'm not yelling at them.
Well, first of all, you're never going to make it as a basketball coach at Rutgers, so don't even apply to
No,
that job.
no, no. It's not.
But in seriousness, speaking of that, challenging guys, some of the drills that you write about and that I've read before, and I think I've even seen a few over the years that you have them do, they seem to me to be very unorthodox. And maybe that's just compared to what I remember from basketball camp years ago. But I want to quickly describe two of them that you talk about in the book that you're doing with Carmelo Anthony at one point. One of them involves catching a tennis ball with one hand while dribbling a basketball with the other hand and moving in different directions based on commands that you're shouting out, or not shouting in this case, like you said,
Let me
but
explain that drill for you.
mm-hmm.
What exactly we do? Well, sometimes people want to focus so much on the drill, and it's not so much the drill, it's everything that comes with the drill. So, for example, I'm trying to teach myself how to cook, so I watch the Food Network all the time. So, if Mario Batali and I both had the exact same piece of steak, the same salt, the same pepper, and the same oven, I can assure you his steak will taste 10 million times better than mine. Right?
Yeah, well, he's Mario Batali. I hope so.
No, of course, but it's the same ingredients, right? It's the something about how he prepares it. It's maybe the how he flicks the salt from his finger onto the steak. Maybe it's just there's a lot that goes into what he does. There's a lot of love, and then there's an environment that creates. There's something special about what he does. So a lot of times people will see a drill and think, oh, it's just about a drill. Let me just mimic the drill. And it's crap. I mean, the drill is a part of it, but there's so much more to the drill. So years ago, I was shooting a commercial for Nike Jordan brand with Carmelo, and the director wanted to see what Melo does when he works out. So I show them a drill that we do, and essentially Melo's catching a tennis ball with one hand while dribbling a basketball in the other, moving in different directions according to what I say to him. And the commercial turned out great. And then months later, I would just start seeing all these coaches and trainers just mimicking this drill that they saw on TV. And I thought, what a shame, because it's not about mimicking the drill, because you missed the entire point of this. They think it's about developing Melo's eye-hand coordination. Melo's one of the best athletes in the world. At 9 years old, he developed that. The whole point of the drill was to create a sensory overload. So when you play the game of basketball at the highest level, you have the ball in your hands and you're dribbling it. You have so many things going on. You have a coach who's yelling at you to run an offense. You have aggressive, long defenders trying to steal the ball from you. You have teammates who are trying to demand the ball and having them pass you pass them the ball. You have cheerleaders on the sideline. You have photographers. You have a shot clock. You have fans talking crap behind you. There's so much stuff going on right there that you forget about the ball. It's the same idea. So when Melo's dribbling a basketball and I'm tossing different things in his direction, I'm asking him to move in different ways. He's focusing on all that except for the basketball. And that's kind of how he learns to play.
Right, so it's not. Did you say it's not the tennis? The tennis ball is just a means to that end. You could be there flipping flashcards with numbers and asking
Exactly.
him to call, do addition and subtraction or division. It's the same kind of
Right.
effect.
Exactly. And so but there's such a focus on drill, 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 drill. And I'm
Right.
thinking it's not always the drill, it's everything that is associated with it.
Well, speaking of drills, you also write about how a lot of times, at least when you were coming into this, you saw basketball skills training. It often seemed to mimic golf skills training, and that maybe that wasn't the best or the most efficient way to improve with the things that these guys really need to improve on. Can you explain sort of the difference there and sort of what you learned and what was maybe missing for some of the traditional ways of practicing?
I mean, golf is static, right? You're just sitting there for 15 seconds before you decide to hit it. There's not a conditioning element to it. I mean, I guess I don't know that much about golf, but I mean, you're not running a 200-meter sprint before you stop and hit the ball, right? So
Right.
I found that a lot of times when I'd watch training and like in basketball, it was static, and I just didn't make sense to me because the game is so fluid and you're always having to move. So I didn't understand why people would put skill in one box and athletics and conditioning and quickness and agility in another. To me, they had to be merged.
And so to do that, what kind of things did you develop, and how much of that came out of sort of your own trial and error?
It's all trial and error. I'm not part of the institution. I can't regurgitate their philosophy. I didn't play in the NBA. I didn't play Division I college basketball. I didn't play Division II. I didn't play Division III. And if there was a Division IV, I didn't play that either.
NAIA.
Right? This is something that I just taught myself.
I believe that would be Division Four.
Right, it's just something I taught myself over the years, trial and error. Like what works, what doesn't. What works for a certain guy might not work for somebody else. So if you're going to shoot the ball, you better not shoot it stationary because I don't know how many shots you take shooting stationary. This isn't a game of horse. This isn't Dave and Buster's, right? And I just found that that to me was something important, is that to create a situation where it really mimicked the game.
That seems like a really almost obvious thing to do. I mean, you actually will hear basketball coaches and coaches say, you know, practice the way you pray, practice the way you play. Now, usually they're just referring to sort of intensity level. But if you took them really literally, you would think they would have been doing that too a little more.
I guess, but I think, you know, sometimes the most sophisticated things are the most obvious ones, right?
Right. Well, you don't have that traditional coaching background. Like you said, you actually went to law school and worked as a lawyer for a while.
Yeah, I was a lawyer for several years.
You detail in this book, but for people listening, and if you want to get really into this, you can. If you want to do more of a nutshell, you can. How did you get from there, being a lawyer, and being an unhappy lawyer, by the way, to being here, and which, by the way, is not just, you know, quitting law to open a cupcake shop, no offense to that, we've seen that story a lot of places, but, you know, becoming a trainer to some of the best, and in some ways, most inaccessible people in their profession?
You know, sometimes I think people are looking for the sexy answer, like I was walking on the island of Fiji and a coconut hit me over the head and like I was discovered, but it wasn't that. It was many, many, many years of trying. So, you know, I grew up in a observant Jewish home to immigrant parents who've devoted their whole life to teaching Jewish education. So you can imagine there weren't a lot of like athletic resources available to me as a kid, but I fell in love with the game and I became pretty good at it. I taught myself everything. And my only dream was to play major Division I college basketball and to look over to the sidelines and see Mike Krzyzewski and Roy Williams arguing over whose scholarship I was going to take. But you can imagine, growing up the way I did, that's not really an option that doesn't happen. So you only have a few career choices when you grow up like me. You can become a rabbi, a doctor, an accountant, an engineer, a teacher, or a lawyer. So I checked the lawyer box.
Okay.
So years later, I'm a lawyer. I'm sitting in my office and I'm absolutely miserable, just miserable with a capital M-I-S-E-R-A-B-L-E, right? Just terrible. It's awful. And when you grow up religious, the only thing you know how to do is pray. So I would just sit behind my desk every morning and just pray that God would send down a lightning bolt through the sky and impale itself in my desk with all these little yellow stickies attached to it with an answer for my future. But there was never any lightning bolt. There were never any like immediate answers for my prayers. And so just to escape the office, I just started volunteering at a YMCA with 12-year-old boys. And pretty soon the parents start calling me and telling me they've never seen their children so engaged in anything in their entire life. And I thought, well, maybe I just know more about the dad who's coaching his son's team. And at the end of the season, all the boys had pooled their allowance money to throw me a pizza party. And I thought, this is unusual. You know, boys buy video games with their money. They're not buying some adult they barely know pizza.
So I thought, usually it's the other way around.
Right, exactly. So I thought maybe I was just connecting with these kids because I was a good teacher and I inherited a teaching gene from my parents, who were both teachers. Mm-hmm. So I'm still, you know, miserable at the office, still volunteering whenever I can. And then one day I just got annoyed and I quit. So now I moved back home, trying to figure out what I'm going to do with my life. You know, you're getting this pressure. You got to go back to law. That's what you're meant to do. That there's stability there. There's a 401k there. There's an office. There's a check every 2 weeks. Yada yada yada. So I end up just running into a couple guys that I used to play in the park with, just happenstance. And I was like, You know, you guys, let's go in the gym and work on a few things. Never in a million universes did I think it would ever lead me to where I am now. It was just to offer them to work on their game. And I don't know why I offered it. It just happened. So very soon, I just did the drills with them that I had done when I was a kid, drills that I had made up for myself. And they liked it, and they wanted to come back again and again and again. And soon, better players would come. And soon, even better players would come. And soon, professional players would come. And eventually, NBA guys would come. And meanwhile, still, I was feeling pressure to go back to law. So I took a job with an awesome firm called Sherman & Sterling. And it's filled with great people, smart people, encouraging people. You know, I made a good living. But when you take off all the makeup, it was still law, and I just wasn't for me. So I'm still volunteering whenever I have time just to get out of the office, you know, weekends, mornings, whenever, right? And one day my mom, I'm having lunch with her a few years later, and she says, "Do you charge the players that you work with?" And that was a hard question for me to answer because I didn't. I mean,
and we're talking about NBA players now. We're talking about people definitely with money that could afford to pay you something.
Yeah, and I mean, it never in a million years did it cross my mind to make money for any of this.
Did they ever offer you anything?
No, it wasn't even a conversation. It was just pure joy. It was like, "Hey, I'll see you at 7. Awesome, I'll see you at 7. It didn't even dawn on me that that could even be a conversation.
Do you think that helped you in a way, because it helped you learn how to either build trust, or it helped you earn trust or be trusted by these guys? Because I've got to think, in their position, people are constantly coming to them wanting to sell them something.
No, I think it helped me because what it represents. I mean,
Really?
if give me 10 more seconds, I'll finish the story and then I'll kind of
Sure.
leave. Like, okay. So for a few months, like that, my mom's question just rattled me because my entire life I had associated making money with what I hated. How all of a sudden could I make a living doing what I would do otherwise do for free? So I ended up getting a call from Elton Brand, who was playing for the Los Angeles Clippers at the time, and he wanted to work with me, and I said, sure. And at the end of the conversation, I said it as fast as I freaking could. I said, pay whatever you think this is worth to you, hoping that he didn't even hear me. He could have paid me with a bag of Starburst, jelly beans. I didn't care less. Just something that I could turn around and show my mom I got some M&Ms, leave me alone, don't bother me. And then I ended up getting a check from him with more zeros than I had ever seen. And I'm not a millionaire, but it was more than I had made, right? And it came with just, it was beautiful. But I felt so uncomfortable, I wanted to push the check across the table.
Why did you feel so uncomfortable at that point?
Because your whole life you had associated making money with what you hated. I was doing this for free. I didn't care about money. And all of a sudden, someone was willing to pay you what you would do for free. It's a very strange sensation. I didn't grow up with money. I never had money. And all of a sudden, to have a check, it almost felt unnecessary to me because I still would have done it regardless. But that moment was very poignant, not because of a trust situation, because it represented this was the end of my internship in Edon Ravine LLC. I had spent all these years learning, creating, developing, getting like creating confidence, figuring things out. And at that moment, when I get paid, I realize, you know what? I'm no longer an intern. Now I have value, and now I can treat this more like a business. So when people talk about the trust with the players, no, it was more of a trust in myself. Now I actually could do this.
I could do this. This is like I make a living doing this.
Yeah, I could. Yes, exactly. And that's what it represented in some ways.
Interesting. So, I want to fast forward a lot ahead a lot here, just to the right now. Obviously, because like the playoffs are going on. I'm curious when you're watching games. I'm assuming you're watching games, and you're
Yes.
watching your clients, but you're also watching other players too. Guys, maybe you know through your clients, or guys you don't know. You like basketball. How do you see the game in ways that like an average fan might not? What are you watching for? What do you see? That even someone like myself, who's a journalist and has covered the league a little bit, just wouldn't even be aware of.
I don't even like to call on my clients. It's too formal. I don't. I mean, they're people I work with, and they're people I'm friends with. With respect to what I see, I think I see things more in patterns and rhythm, right? And, like when you're a kid, you take all those tests, and they tell you like what block doesn't belong here, or what's the next number you should expect to see. And that's kind of how I see a lot of life and how I see the game. So I'm just looking for certain patterns, and if the patterns don't necessarily fit, then I kind of red flag it. Some of the stuff you want to kind of ask me is kind of proprietary with respect to the guys that I work with, so I can't go into full detail.
Sure.
But
What's something without that wouldn't be giving away, something that might give a competitive advantage or disadvantage to one of these guys? Is there something that you can talk about that's pretty well known or that they would be okay with?
I mean, let's go to Roy Hibbert, right? I mean, there's
Let
somebody I know.
let's because everyone is kind of wondering what's going on with him. How's he doing? How was he able to turn around last game? What's
So Roy Hibbert is an example of when I watch him, right away I know what's wrong. And I don't know Roy, but I've been around this long enough to kind of just feel it. So in some ways, Roy resembles Dwight Howard in some respects. And I've worked with Dwight for a long time, and he's one of my favorite people on this planet. So in Dwight's situation, the world said to him, you can't shoot, you can't shoot, you can't shoot free throws, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know what happens? Eventually, when everyone tells you what you can't do, eventually you're going to start to listen to some of it. So imagine going into work every day and someone said to you, are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay? What's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? Eventually you're going to start thinking something's wrong with you,
Right,
right?
or I would just explode eventually. It's the first
Right.
person, last person asked me that. But something
It's
would be wrong with me at that point.
right. So then, so what's the, so you start kind of internalizing this. And with
Right.
whatever situation, he's a very smart guy, he's a very talented guy, he's a cerebral guy, and imagine he's a little bit sensitive guy, which is human and okay. Is that enough people tell you what's wrong, what's wrong, what's wrong? You're going to start thinking that, damn, maybe something's wrong. And at the end of the day, there's nothing wrong. Basketball is a game of imperfection. 50% from two is considered good, 40% from three is considered good, and 80% from the line is considered good. You are expected not to be perfect every single day, regardless of what the damn NBA might say to you, right? I think it's like we need to have a little bit more compassion and back off the kid, right? Be more supportive. Say, you know what? I'm going to run the first few plays to you. I'm going to help build your confidence back up. I understand. And I don't, it might not happen today or tomorrow, but build him back up. Don't break him down. Because at the end of the day, he's become an all-star. So he's not crap. He's obviously very, very, very good.
It would look like
Something.
that's exactly what they did in
Right.
last
And then
night.
you start like believing in him again. And he starts believing in himself again. Then he digs himself out of the hole, and then you see the great Roy Hibbert that he is. But every single day to hear the same crap about, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that, eventually gets irritating. And he starts believing it.
You know, it's interesting in the book how much of, and this is where I think the title Hoops Whisperer actually kind of fits. It's interesting how much of what happens is about you learning the psyche of the players you're training.
Yeah.
Learning who they are, like what works for, like learning what works for them requires learning a lot about who they are, what motivates them. I mean, I'm sure this is what coaches have to learn too, but you seem to, you know, you're working with them at such an intimate level, such a personal level, such focused attention. It seems like, you know, you're able to take a lot of different lessons from them.
Yeah.
I want to know if I could maybe, and that, by the way, that squeaking in the background is I have a podcast guest today. It's my dog in the background taping this from home. So if anybody hears that, he's got a toy. He's a little excited. I want to go through a couple of the players that you've worked with, and just if you can give me a thumbnail of sort of what you learned about getting the best out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Can we do that? I want to start with Kobe Bryant, who was somebody you worked with at one point, sort of briefly. What did you learn about him?
I haven't spent that much time with Kobe, but I have a lot of respect for the guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I always tell him when I see him that they're, like, his life is no coincidence. He is everything that he wanted. He's made himself into this guy. He is incredibly devoted and committed to this process. And I think a lot of times people assume that, you know, Kobe Bryant came out of his mother's womb 6'7", 225 pounds, dribbling a basketball. But I can assure you he didn't. Everything that he has, he's earned for himself. And I think that's when it just amazes me about him. It's that he's, you know, I remember when I was, you know, studying, when I was a lawyer and I was studying for the California Bar.
Mm-hmm.
And for probably 3 months, I probably studied 17, 18 hours a day. I don't know how I did it, but I did. But that's how Kobe lives his life. It's 18 hours a day for the last 38 years, just completely committed to what he loves to do. It's remarkable. And, you know, some people say they don't like him. They do like him. It really doesn't matter because he doesn't care, right? The point is that he's just devoted to what he loves, and his goal is to be the best that ever played the game.
Kevin Durant.
Incredibly special guy. I don't think that there's many people on this planet that have such excellence and humility at the same time. And that's why in the book, you know, the chapter talks about like mm-hmm. that the humility and the success can coexist, because it takes a real killer to succeed in the NBA. But at the same time, he's incredibly gentle and kind and compassionate and giving and modest. And he's truly amazing.
How do you sort of balance those two things? And I said, you know, I think sometimes as fans and definitely as sports writers, we tend to sort of look for grand unifying theories of people. We tend to oversimplify them. When I say people, I mean the athletes that we're watching and writing about and discussing. With someone like Kevin, you know, is it really that unusual that he could have these two different sides to him? Or is that just, does that say more about us that we think that's unusual?
Well, I think it's unusual because I'm trying to phrase this the right way. You're playing a game with a lot of lions. Right? These are like uber competitive, strong, like in that world, if you don't try to grab the bread off the plate, you're not going to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's one Gatorade campaign. There's one Sprite campaign. It's like all the great guys are going for that. And his desire is incredible. But yet at the same time, he's able to maintain perspective. I mean, there's a lot of people who've been success and they turn into a-holes. This guy's a gem. He will sign out every autograph, shake every hand, smile, modest, like, appreciates where he's come from, like honors his family. It's a shame that I have to call it unusual, because I would love to say that more people are like that, but they're not.
I mean, it seems like almost like for him, personality-wise, a little bit of a Render Under Caesar kind of thing where, okay, I can turn this kind of killer instinct or focus to basketball. It doesn't have to be every aspect of my life.
Yeah. And that's why I say, like, he's programmed different than other people.
How about Steph Curry? Someone else you work with, someone else who's, unfortunately, I'm very sad, is out of the playoffs now, because it's probably my favorite player to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But just, again, you know, what have you learned about his psyche? Like, what is it that not only maybe makes him good, but when you work, you want to train him to make him better, you know, how do you get the best out of him?
What makes Steph so interesting is that he doesn't look the part. And now these people would sort of, when he came out of college, and even, I think even a few years into the NBA, everyone would challenge him because he comes from privilege. It's like, his father played in the NBA and had a family, middle class, great parents. And people would think, oh, you know what? You're religious. You're not tough. You're a rich kid. What do you know about basketball other than what you learned from your dad? And there was this, like, people would judge him, and I would laugh. I'm thinking, you guys don't understand what toughness is. Toughness is not how hard you punch. Toughness is protecting what you love. And this guy absolutely loves the game and was committed to prove everybody wrong. And I remember working with him before the draft, and people like, oh, this kid from Davidson, he played at a weak school, he can't really jump, he can't really he doesn't move that fast, he's small. And I remember telling these NBA guys, Steph Curry's going to be a superstar because he's learned to play the game in an unusual way, and that's his competitive advantage.
Well, before we ask about a couple of players, let's get into that, the advantage of playing unusually. You have this incredibly interesting metaphor in the book that I wanted to ask you about and have you unpack. You write that basketball has a lot in common with music theory,
Yes.
and that, out of that, players who are unorthodox, like Steph, have that competitive edge. How does that work? A, how does that sort of comparison work? And B, how does it then go to unorthodox players?
Okay, so imagine, like, I see life in a lot of rhythm and beats and that in diagrams. That's how I see things. So if you're listening to a song and you know it's going to go a certain melody, and then let's say, well, it's going to go A to B to C to D, and there's going to be a certain break in between. Well, you're going to pretty much figure out when E's coming. Okay, so imagine when the ball bounces, it's a certain beat: 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000, and then on 4-1000, you're going to expect the ball to bounce. But the way Steph, and I guess we've worked on this a lot, the way he will dribble, the way he will move, the way he will shoot, the way he'll release the ball is all against those rhythms. So when you're a defensive player, you're anticipating a certain rhythm, and Steph will throw you off because you're not going to get that next beat. So if I'm saying, if his dribble is 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000, on number four, it'll be 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000. He'll either speed it up, he'll slow it down. So now it's a guessing game, and you don't know where it's going to come from.
I
So
mean,
that's why it's very much like music in that respect.
is it also similar to the advantage we often say left-handers have in sports?
No, I think because plenty of players play left-handed, and there's plenty of players who play right-handed. And these guys are the most amazing defensive players. They have the best intuition. They play the game their whole life. It's just about, because these movement patterns are so ingrained in defenders, and they're looking for certain things that everybody does, that the minute he becomes unconventional, that becomes his edge.
Is that, by the way, with these defenders, is that a conscious thing or is it an unconscious thing that when you have to guard someone like Steph, it becomes conscious and that's what slows you down?
That's a great question. I think it's obviously there's a level of something that's subconscious, right? I mean, since you were a kid, you learned to take, if you're taking a right-handed layup, you take it off your left foot. I mean, you learn that when you're 6 years old. Now, all of a sudden, Steph's taking every layup off his right hand and right foot. That's going to throw you off a little bit, and it's going to take you a second to realize that. And then the minute you adjust, he goes back to his left foot.
I want to ask you about Chris Paul. Speaking of another player who you worked with right before they came into the league, and it sounded like you would tell everybody that you could, this guy's going to be a star. This guy's going to
Oh,
be great.
yes. And no one wanted to hear me.
But really, I mean, obviously, I really love watching him play. I think everybody's really enjoying this matchup with Russell Westbrook.
Yeah.
It's fantastic to see that. It's kind of like two guys that are sort of at the top of their games, but also do it in different ways. What can you tell us about Chris Paul, his psyche, his approach? Again, when you train him, what works with him?
It's In some ways, like, a lot of the guys have this similarity, which is they are, I hate to use this word, but they're killers on the court, and then they're righteous people off the court. And it's their ability to manage that, which gives them a lot of perspective, right? And Chris is very much like Steph. He comes from an amazing family, great parents. The church is a very big part of his life, his kids, the community. But then when he plays the game, he plays it like it's his last day. And I have just tremendous respect for that. It's like it matters to him so much. Not necessarily, it's, I guess, the win or the loss, but the effort and what it represents. And like I say, he's an absolute lion on the court, and he's the gentlest guy off. And I think his ability to kind of go back and forth, like the way Kevin does, the way Steph Curry does, the way Dwight does, the way Carmelo does, make them special people.
How about Joakim Noah? Because there's a guy, again, incredible defensive player. I don't know if people would consider him orthodox or not. I mean, he looks a little bit unorthodox to me when I watch him play. I don't know if he has that same level of advantage the way someone like Steph would. But his game's a little different. He's incredibly valuable, but he's valuable in ways that the casual fan of basketball doesn't notice right away. You have to really be into the Bulls, watch him for a while, then you start to realize, wow, this guy does so many things on the floor, and I'm going to miss half of them or most of them if I'm not watching the ball. When you're working a guy like that, how is it different than when you're working with a ball dominant player or someone we know as a scorer or distributor or something like that?
I mean, I think there's still fundamental things that you have to do with him with the ball, right? I mean, at the end of the day, that's what makes the game fun. I mean, no one wants to play soccer and never kick it. Then you're
Well,
not soccer, you're just running track.
maybe the goalie. The goalies are a little weird in soccer.
Right. No, exactly. But I mean, at the end of the day, this is a game where they have to dribble, run, shoot,
Right.
have the ball in their hands. So obviously the workouts have the ball in their hands. But what I call Joakim a fire starter. I mean, he'll make fire out of nothing, right? It's the energy that he plays with and the care that he has. And, for him, I guess sexiness is a weird word. I think for him, sexy is getting rebounds, blocking shots, winning games, running the court, distributing, being the big man who can get a triple double. Sexy to him is not always getting 30 and 15, as other people would define it.
Can you
So
but speak of
you might say he's some people might say he's like a worker bee, and I think no, he just defines it differently than what everybody else does.
well speaking of some of those things, can you as a trainer, can you work with someone on improving their shot blocking the way you can work with someone on improving their
Of
shot?
course. Yeah, of course. I mean, you can work on everything. It's just whether it's just how you present it to the athletes, right? I mean, it's like it goes back to the idea of the drill. If it was just about the drill, then I can assure you everybody could run the triangle offense and win 11 championship rings. But there's been plenty of coaches who run the triangle offense and haven't won a lick. So it's not so much about the drill, it's about the delivery. It's like how you present it to the athlete, how the drill resonates with the athlete, how they feel after they do it. Do they feel challenged? Do they feel like it's going to work? Does it become intuitive? Yeah, so you can work with a lot of things on players.
What happens when you run through something with a guy and doesn't seem good? They don't seem into it.
It's never happened.
Never happened. Never had one drill that was a bust or a dud.
No, I mean, no, because I think through a lot of this. I mean, it's never been a bust. Sometimes they might just say, you know what, like I don't know if like this is going to necessarily work for me right now, but it's definitely challenging. So you just maybe try to refine the drill a little bit to make it more specific to them. But I've never had someone say, oh, this is stupid. No, I mean, that's never ever.
That's good. That's a good track record. You talk about, making half your shots being great. That's a lot better than half. Let me ask you about LeBron James. Obviously, I mean, it's at the peak of the league right now. Again, another guy who's just a pleasure to watch. You write about the moment where he lost his headband against the Spurs in the playoffs last year, Game 6, elimination game, and then played without it the rest of the way. And you say this is actually a really big deal. This is a small detail that was a really big deal, and maybe even an insight into, how his psyche works. Break that down for me.
I don't know. I guess maybe this is sometimes it's sort of it's like the weird things that I might see, right? And I always just saw like the headband as being representative of maybe a little bit just being embarrassed that kind of your hairline's receding. And again, this is not something like he's ever shared with me or I've discussed with anybody. It was just kind of an observation. And it's normal. A lot of people, I shave my head bald, and at that moment when you're losing your hair a little bit, you start feeling a little bit insecure, especially when the whole world sees you, right? So I always thought that's what the headband represented. And when he got it knocked off his head, I was happy because at that moment he was completely naked out there. And all that mattered was him playing and scoring and winning and not all the other crap that comes with basketball. And I thought it was just a huge moment. And like I thought it was awesome that he didn't put it back on his head.
Oh, so he wasn't worried about what other people thought of him.
Yes, that's exactly what it
That was
represented.
always kind of the knock against him, was it not? I mean, it's sort of the, again, I'm not saying it's like, obviously there's lots of ways he improved his game over the years in the NBA, but when people sort of played armchair psychologists, they always would say, this is a guy that's worried so much about what other people think that maybe it holds him back sometimes.
No, absolutely. But you have to like also have compassion for them. At the end of the day, like he's an icon, right? So how could things not matter to him? How could the consumer perception not matter? I mean, he has a $100 billion deal with Nike. I mean, he's like the guy is a success in so many different areas. So of course it matters to him. It matters to Coca-Cola what the consumer thinks.
Sure.
Well, why wouldn't it matter to LeBron James?
And I would also add, I would think as a human being, like all of us kind of care what other people think about us, at least to some degree. I mean, the only people that really don't at all are generally, you know, they're toward the extreme side on the sort of psychopathic spectrum of things.
Right.
Like, you should care what people think about you at some level.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it's important for the most part not to care, but to care about the people who care for you.
Right.
Like, that's different. And for me, it's like the people who care for him couldn't care less whether his head shaved, wears a mohawk, or, you know, he has a mullet, right? Those people don't care. And then that's where I was really happy for him. And I remember seeing him this summer, and I was ecstatic. I was like, you know, he's getting married. He's got a wonderful family. He's won 2 championships. He's been MVP. He's devoted. He's serious. His business is awesome. I mean, I wish nothing but the best for the guy.
I think that's something we forget, by the way, as fans especially, but maybe even as journalists, that all these people, when we're talking about athletes, we're talking about like relatively young men, for the most part, young women. We're talking about people that they might see, you know, again, you look at them, they're so impressive at what they do. They're the best in the world at what they do. You know, physically, they're often really, really impressive. Like you said, a lot of these people, they're really bright. But they still, you know, they're people that can feel embarrassed about a receding hairline. They're people that still have the same ordinary kind of feelings the rest of us have.
Yeah, and I think at the end of the day, what we forget is that we see the professional athlete and we think they live on the golden palace on the top of the hill and that they're insulated from all the frustration and heartache and struggle that we are. And the reality, we're not. And that's what the Donald Sterling incident represented to me, is that racism is still institutional. It still affects tons and tons of people. And these professional athletes are still not insulated from it, even if they have millions of dollars.
Right.
And I think we have to ask ourselves, you know what? Everyone's like, oh, yeah, but they make $60 million. You know what? At the end of the day, nonsense. Because if you were the best doctor in the world, you'd make a ton of money. If you were the best lawyer in the world, you'd make a ton of money. If you were the best radio host in the world, you'd make a ton of money. So money is not part of this equation. What we have to understand is that they're still human. They still suffer. They still struggle. They still get frustrated. And all the things that we do. And I think it's important for us to have more compassion when we see them struggle.
Speaking of struggle and compassion, you actually just did a perfect segue in the next thing I want to talk about. You've worked with players coming back from injury, coming back from loss of confidence, or both. Players, I mean, I'm here in D.C., I'm thinking about Gilbert Arenas, someone you work with. So, someone who I covered, you know, met his dad, wrote about him. He's got a really interesting backstory. Someone who, you know, things went very badly here at the end for Gilbert. You worked with Dwight Howard, who had a really rough time in Los Angeles and on the way out in Orlando. I'm wondering if you could perhaps, how do you, when you're working with Gilbert, when you're working with Dwight, how do you approach them? How do you sort of help them when they're coming from that place? As opposed to being like, I'm doing great, but I want to get better. You're coming from a place of like, I've been knocked down and I actually need some help.
But understand, like, they're not going to, not everyone is as eloquent as you, right? And it's my responsibility to understand them. So I'm not a therapist, I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not a psychologist. I'm just a person that works with a lot of intuition and I care for the people I work with. So I think guys know that immediately, otherwise they wouldn't deal with me because there's a million people they can choose from. They have every resource in the world. So when a guy walks into a gym and we get started, I can assure you I'm not giving him the Newt Rockne speech. I'm not telling him, you know, keep your chin up, and, you know, fall tomorrow, get up today, all those stupid cliches. We just get started. And then slowly, it's a work in progress. And then every day, we work towards creating better. And better can be messages, better can be texts, better can be over lunch, can be a lot of things. But it's not a session where you sit on the couch and I'm telling you, you got to believe in yourself. Believe. You know, that's not cliche like that.
Well, I mean, I would think, you know, someone can tell you up and down, believe in yourself. But I mean, in general, I would think belief comes from actually accomplishing things, from doing things, from seeing success. You know, I would think otherwise it's kind of hollow. Like, I would think the actual working with you is what would help rekindle maybe self-belief.
And at the end of the day, like, it's not also about believing yourself. It's to understand that people who are in your corner believe in you. I don't get a commission on these deals. I'm not the agent. I don't need to feed you crap, right? I'm in here because I believe in you. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in here. And I think they feel that energy and they understand that I'm there for them. And slowly every day we do things to help rekindle that love for the game, to make them feel better, to enjoy the game and to see progress. But it's not something that happens overnight. It never does. That to me is the commercial with the guy thrown up in the trash can and the coach giving the Newt Rockne speech. That's not how it works.
Do you have in some, like in a sort of psychological way, any kind of getting back to an orthodox and advantage of the advantage of being orthodox, your relationship compared to a traditional coach who works for the team, that could be hired and fired by the team, those kinds of things, has all these other concerns. Do you have a sort of an advantage in terms of how you can connect with players? Because you're not in that position of team management, you're not sitting in, you don't have at least one foot in that world as
No,
well.
my allegiance is to the players. That's all I care about, is to make sure that they're better, and that's my complete focus.
You
So
write
that
some,
is an advantage. You're right.
you write something interesting. The word selfish. You say it's misunderstood in sports, and that you tell your players to be more selfish, but you mean that in a very specific way. What do you mean by
I
that?
think selfish to me has a strange connotation in sport, as if the idea is just because you shot the ball, that's you're selfish, but if you pass the ball, you're unselfish. But I can assure you there's plenty of people that pass the ball because they're selfish, because they want to add up on their stats, and there's plenty of people who don't shoot the ball who are selfish. It's all nonsense. To me, selfish means self-reliant, complete responsibility for you. Don't expect your coaches to help you, don't expect your buddies to help you, don't expect your team to help you, don't expect anyone to help you. Be completely selfish in your commitment. And I think that is what I tell my guys all the time, because you can only control you. Winning is out of your control.
How did you develop that philosophy?
How did I develop that philosophy? Just something I've always believed in. I mean, it's not like I didn't go to school for it, right? I mean,
Was that, I mean, is there experiences that you've had that sort of brought you to that place, or is that something you've always felt even
that's how
when
I
you were
live my
starting out?
life, right? I'm not part of the establishment. I didn't grow up from the establishment. I don't share a jersey and a resume of college and professional basketball like the establishment. I'm a self-made guy. I've done this. I do what I love to do because I built this with my hands. And it came because I was self-reliant. I didn't. No one gave me the chance. No one said, "Oh, you're related to blah blah blah," and I'm going to give you a job as an intern with the team. No, I built this on myself because I was selfish and self-reliant, and that to me is a strong message and something I convey to them every single day.
Speaking of not being from the establishment, we mentioned this a little earlier. I want to get into it more. You talk about not raising your voice when you're dealing with guys.
Never.
When you write about how you, this is what you say. You say, "I have no intention of becoming a tyrant or a marionette," which I really like the imagery there of both of those. And you also talk about how you don't understand why that's accepted still in the establishment to yell at players or curse at them. As you say, I like this quote, so I'm going to quote you. "You don't yell and scream at your employees when you work at Apple, unless you're the genius and you found the company." How did you come to that? And why do you find sort of, I guess, I'm not going to say traditional, but sort of that, like you said, the tough love, I'm only yelling at you because I care about you approach
It's
to be
cool.
counterproductive?
I mean, I don't understand why it works and why it's acceptable. I mean, in any office, to raise your voice and curse at someone, the human resources would be summoned right away. But yet it's okay in sport to yell and curse. I don't get it. What does tough coaching mean? Tough coaching means you're not eloquent enough to kind of say it in a way that the player can understand, right? It's not the player's fault. It's the coach, the administration, it's the organization's fault. I don't tolerate it, and I've never done it, and I never will. I don't curse at my guys. I don't raise my voice at them. If I raise my voice, it's an encouragement and applause, not to critique them. And if
Right,
you think
the
that,
idea of I can't get this across to you, so what if I said it louder? Maybe that would
exactly,
work.
it makes no sense to me. Then you know what? Go back and figure out how to say it in a better way, right? But the system is filled with people who played, and they just regurgitate philosophy after philosophy. I played for this guy who did it this way, so I'm just going to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it, and it becomes this Ten Commandments of nonsense.
Do you find, I mean, have any guys who work with ever told you, "Hey, this is refreshing. I actually appreciate your approach," or, "I wish, all coaches approach this way," or do you have any
No.
feedback on that, or is that an unspoken thing?
No, I mean, they wouldn't come back if they didn't like it, right? I don't need I don't I don't need they don't fill out a customer service questionnaire when we're done.
You don't have an ideas box at the end of the
No,
session?
I don't. There's no tip box. I'm not selling cafe lattes and Honda Accords, right? They just come back and they text me the next day. I'll say, "I'll see you tomorrow," right? And they come back just as excited as they did the day before. That's all I need to know.
How much of that coaching at this point still exists in the NBA from just again from your experience?
I'm
Do you
sure. I mean, again, I don't fault people for doing that because that's all they know and that's what they think works. And again, I'm no expert. I don't know everything. I'm not the guru. I just know what works for me, and what works for me is to respect them and talk to them in a certain way. So I can't speak to what a million people do. Maybe they like that. I mean, it's like, I would never do that.
Do you feel more accepted at this point by that establishment?
You know, honestly, I couldn't care less. I just focus on my guys. They trust me with something that falls second in their life between God, family, and health. And that's their game, and I hold that with tremendous reverence. All the other crap and the critics and whatever, I couldn't care less what they think. My only focus is these guys.
Any teams ever approached you? Want to bring you on to be proprietary, exclusive, just work with our team?
Yeah, I mean, of course I have that all the time, right? But I mean, to me, it's more right now in my stage of my life, it's more important to kind of be focused on my players and have certain flexibilities and be self-employed and, you know, be able to like do things that I love to do that I didn't realize I love to do. Like, I never really thought I would love writing, and it's something that I really enjoy, and I hope I can write 26 more books, you know? So there's a level of freedom that I enjoy and like I hope I continue to have.
Before we get out of here, let me ask you one more question.
Yep.
Playoffs, what's your favorite series right now to watch and why?
Oh man, you're asking me a tough question because I can't root for God between guys. So what I'm going to tell you is that as long as Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, and Kevin Durant both score 100 points, then I'm happy. You know, as long as
That's all. That get the three of them together to 100 points? That's
I
all.
know what I mean. You know, I just want each one of the guys to play amazing. I don't
Sure.
can choose between teams. As long as each one plays amazing, then I'm happy for them.
See, I think you have the right idea. So much easier than just rooting for teams and being lifted up and crushed. Just
Yeah,
root for players you like.
my guys, that's it.
It's
You know,
better odds. You have more guys across more teams, more chance they're going to keep going.
exactly.
Well, look, Edon Ravine, thank you so much for your time. Before we go, tell us again the book and also how people can find you online.
The book is called The Hoops Whisperer: On the Court and Inside the Heads of Basketball's Best Players. It's in bookstores nationwide as well as airports. It's also on Amazon and iBooks. You can find me. My website is edonravine.com, IDANRAVIN.com. And you can also find me on Twitter and Instagram under the name Edon Wan, spelled IDANWAN.
Edon, this has been great. Really enjoyed it. Hope to have you back maybe next NBA season. We can talk a little more.
Let me know. I had a great time.
Until next time, I am Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.